All right, so hello everybody. Welcome to the first podcast of this Values Network. But before we start, just a reminder that this project is part of a grant funded by the European Union. Views and opinions that will be expressed during this podcast are, however, those of the authors only and do not necessarily reflect those of the European Union or the European Education and Culture Executive Agency. So neither the European Union nor the European Education and Culture Executive Agency can be held responsible for them. So without further ado, let me first welcome our first guest of this series of podcasts that we're going to have for the next 3 years, Professor Tim Byhelt from Jadrina University, who's the principal investigator of this grant. So maybe before we start discussing the details of this network, what it will be studying for the next 3 years, the different partners that are also part of this consortium, maybe I will let you first introduce yourself, who you are, the type of research you've done in the past, those you're currently doing, and those you're planning to do in the future. So, Tim.
Yeah, thank you, Jean-François, for inviting me. It's really a pleasure to be in this network. I have studied political science, economics, and Russian literature at Heidelberg University, and I've been at Jadrina for more than 25 years now. It's a small university dedicated to studying Europe on geographic terms, if you wish. So it's not on the European Union, but on Europe as a continent with its global contexts. So this is the task of Jadrina, and I'm happy to be here as a professor for European studies. We have a European studies program, which is running quite successfully. And I'm also placed, this is important for me, in the Faculty of Social and Cultural Sciences, or Social and Cultural Studies. We have two different translations of the term Kulturwissenschaft in German, which means that I understand my works as open to cultural contexts. Yeah, politics being embedded not only in societies or in maybe political institutions, but also to cultures, which means meaning production is a big part of my work, which meanings exist around Europe. And this is also how we got to values as an interesting object of an EU-funded project.
All right, so you spoke about values. Can you tell us a bit more about this network, this consortium? What are the different universities that are part of it? What is the objective, the main objective, and maybe the secondary objectives also of this consortium? So can you tell us where the idea of this network came from?
Yeah, the idea came in a smaller group of consortium members, which are now consortium members. Maybe the University of Pittsburgh should be highlighted here. Together with them, we formed, so to say, the nucleus. The idea was to focus on European values as something like a gap construction. On the one hand, you have, at least for the last 20 years, a European Union which is committed, officially and legally committed to human rights, to other political values, political rights. But at the same time, we can see in many of the policy areas or general inaction of the European Union that it does not really arrive at upholding all these values. For example, in migration policy, for example, in the Eurozone crisis. The problem is a bit, any state has this problem, that there is abstract values and that you have to follow them in one or the other way. The problem with the European Union is that in the international arena, but also in its closer context, and even within it, it is very strong in upholding these values. Yeah, there is no military, no strong military or security policy. There is no no power. There is no police. There is, in general, very little administration to the European Union, which means the way it does, it tries to convince others to act in the way it, you know, it works is by convincing these other entities, states, other countries, third countries, through values. And so you have a special problem if you uphold these values politically and then do not follow them. That's different to states which, you know, which have the possibility to bargain, so to say, between real values or values and real politics within their own polity. The European Union does not have that possibility. And so this is how the idea started. Then we put together a group of now 20 universities from 17 countries. We're actually quite proud that we convinced so many universities. It's also challenging, for example, with regard to meetings across, I think, 11 different time zones. And we have a hard time finding slots where everybody can meet. So this is a problem. Yeah, but let's not speak about problems. It's a huge endeavor, I would say, and it's also fun. We are not only doing research, but having different measures of teaching collaboration, student engagement, civil society engagement, and so on.
All right, so can you tell us a little bit more about specifically what are the activities that the consortium will be organizing over the next 3 years? So there's going to be an annual conference every year.
Yeah.
About the teaching collaboration. So can you tell us a few things about what will actually be done more practically over the next 3 years?
Yes, of course. In addition to the annual conference, there is workshops which are funded by the consortium, which are in more or less internal workshops on certain aspects of values. We have a lecture series, which is organized by the universities. You know, if there is an interesting lecture, an interesting guest maybe coming up, it is announced to the consortium as a whole. We have summer schools, three summer schools, which are going to be held simultaneously, probably, because we have the problem of gapping the time zones. Then we have a massive online course, which is in preparation. We have teaching and research collaboration of different kinds. It's hard to name them with one device. So the main idea is also that not everything which is done, you know, is funded in the sense that it's funded once and then over. It's also a lot about resource building, capacity building, linking non-EU universities to EU universities, using different tools which exist within the EU to even enhance cooperation. So it's a network, and at the beginning of a network, you don't really know what's going to be there at the end, but I think I named a few of the measures.
All right. So maybe, like, I'm sure for you that's not a tricky question, but if you were to ask that question to many of your students, probably they would have a hard time answering it. So I'll ask it for you. Maybe that could be a good question for one of your exam. What are these European values? What is so specific about them? What is so different when we're talking about European values? Why can we say that some of them are specifically European and not necessarily Western values, meaning that in North America, in Australia, New Zealand, people living there and these societies are organized more or less around the same values. So in terms of values, what is so specific about the European Union?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tricky question, and maybe it would be, you know, it's hard to answer this in 2 or 3 minutes. First of all, many of the values the EU proposes in international politics vis-a-vis third countries and also internally are, you know, should be seen as universal values. They are laid down in international conventions, international treaties. So there is no way of compromising them inside, in or outside of Europe. So in that sense, they are universal. Thinking about human and political rights. Yeah. So this is, and I said before, why it, you know, why we arrive at a situation where the EU is not able to uphold all of that. But then there is, of course, a different layers. A second layer is that Europe, as we all know, was in ruins in 1945 and in the early 50s. So the very fact of cooperation between, at the beginning, six EG countries, yeah, European countries forming the core of the coal and steel community, was a value in itself. Upholding or building peace against a context and a historical experience which was very much considered as non-peaceful. Yeah? And then this idea enlarged, if you wish, with enlargements, and is until today relevant. We see that there is more and more countries until now trying to join the European Union because of this value of a peaceful development, and also to some extent, even there, if there is shortcomings, creating welfare among the members of the European Union. Yeah, I mean, we know about global inequalities, and we know that the EU, as you know, as some other Western entities, entities of Western capitalism, add to creating global inequality. But still, I mean, it's at least one part of the EU policy to deal with that. And you know, there's nothing wrong, at least as I see it, to work on welfare within, yeah, which can also be to some extent created without harming the rest of the world. So that's the second arena. And then the third arena is what do values of democracy, which have been given to the EU by itself, yeah, by the Charter for Human Rights, for example, what do they mean within? If we have semi-autocratic countries like Hungary at the moment, you know, openly challenging the rule of law, for example. So there is also an element of values which is important. Yeah, and then the fourth element we are also dealing with in the consortium is on Europe and third countries. This is often done under the very broad heading of post-colonialism, which I could define at the moment as the process of Europe and European societies becoming aware of global inequalities and historical injustices which exist. Yeah, if you open textbooks about the European Union and values of the European Union, you often do not even find mentioning of that part of European history. And so it's also, you know, an aspiration of the consortium to open ourselves to these discussions and to somehow link, let's put it, traditional considerations on European values, on human rights, on political values within the EU to the world outside of Europe. And that's also, you know, I haven't mentioned that in detail. We have 8 or 9, I'm not really sure about the number, universities which do not belong to the European Union. It was very important for us to link universities from outside of Europe to the consortium.
Yeah, we're really grateful, because here being in Kazakhstan, it's really important for us to be connected with all these major significant European universities. You spoke about the notion of solidarity, which is one main pillar of the European values. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the notion of social democracy emerged in Europe in the 19th century, especially maybe more with Edward Bernstein, who kind of broke up with the Marxist tradition. So some people are saying that social democracy was actually invented in Europe before spreading all around the rest of the Western world. So would you say that maybe this is one specific value that maybe the rest of the Western societies, like in North America or in Oceania, are not as important as they might be in Europe?
Like social democracy?
Yeah. Like social programs. I feel like these social policies are way more developed in Europe than in the United States, for instance. Or I'm originally from Canada, and many people in Canada are comparing our social policy networks with the countries in Scandinavia, which are kind of the examples of social democracy. So in this perspective, would you say that social democracy is like specifically a European value?
Well, I'm a political scientist mainly, and therefore I'm defining social democracy as a value is maybe a bit problematic. You also have Christian democracy coming from Germany. There is a big Christian Democratic Party, and there is other political movements or political party families which are engaging with bringing together capitalism and the welfare state. Yeah, and so therefore it's not merely social democratic. The fact that the welfare state is more developed in Europe than in other parts of the world certainly has a historical component. We simply don't know if in China or in Kazakhstan there will be strong welfare states, let's say in 50 years or so. It's linked to stages of development, and it, even if it maybe came up first in the industrial societies of England, France, and a few other states, it does not mean that it cannot spread to the rest of the world. So I would more base in socioeconomic development than in values itself, historically speaking. Of course, nowadays it is a very important element of the more of some Western countries within the European Union that the welfare state should be upheld. And differences within the European Union, of course, now bring that welfare state under pressure. And it's probably a specific challenge to hold the balance, to keep up more or less a welfare level in those countries which have developed welfare states by allowing other countries, other societies to keep up. This is, by the way, one element, but this is now a personal statement, which I see problematic in the development of the European Union in the last 10, 15 years, to which extent inner EU migration is hollowing out welfare states in Central and Southeast European countries. Bulgaria would be one example, yeah, where a lot of doctors, a lot of nurses leave the country. It's also a part of the welfare state, and the fact that wages are higher in some other parts of the European Union leads directly to not only brain drain, but work drain and welfare drain from countries like Bulgaria or even some associated countries. So there is certainly an imbalance within the European Union as well.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned that the European Union was established after the Second World War, and one of the main objectives was to prevent that Europe would go to war for a third time. So it's kind of, in a way, can't we say that the European Union is kind of the consecration, the realization of Immanuel Kant's dream of perpetual peace by bringing countries together, by making them cooperate in various fields? So I don't know, in this sense, maybe we could say that the notion of peace and collaboration is more intimately connected with Europe. Maybe that would make it more of a European value, more than a Western value, simply because Europe has experienced the two worst wars that humanity has experienced in its existence. Maybe it's a first question, and maybe related to that question, how would this value in light of what is going on in Ukraine, we can say now that war is once again knocking on Europeans' door, Europe's door. So because there's been this idea of peace and collaboration, maybe there's a notion of pacifism that has developed in Europe over the past 50 years, 60 years, that is maybe preventing European countries from rallying up behind Ukraine and facing this this threat. What would you say about that?
I mean, it's two questions. Yeah, so I start with the second one. You could also argue that the person which did most for foreign security policy, speaking with one voice, is Vladimir Putin. Like 5 years ago, Crimea was occupied, but there was no real unity, let's say, to support Ukraine, which I still see. I mean, there's big differences, at least, yeah, to what we have today. Not only in Germany, but also in Germany, the state of mind concerning the necessity to defend the own country, but also Europe and the European Union has increased very much, you know. And foreign policy, security policy is probably the most important element defining sovereignty of a state, yeah, external sovereignty. So we should not expect that this simply vanishes, you know, within 1, 2, or 3 years. It took many, many countries in the EU decades, and now this process has been accelerated quite a bit by Ukraine. So, of course, I don't have a solution now how to deal with super aggressive third countries like Russia at the moment. But in the network, we at least discuss to which extent European foreign policy, which is also a trade policy, association policy, you know, has been the wisest in the past, because at least, you know, around 2014, for example, when the association agreement with Ukraine was negotiated, at least there could have been other paths of development. Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to say this for me, because there is also always a danger that you're accused of speaking with Russia's voice. But if we go back to 2013 or 2014, I mean, there were windows of opportunity for further negotiation, and there was not a necessity, I think, that 8 years later there would be a full-blown attack of Russia on Ukraine. I mean, which is largely also a problem of Russia, and which, you know, which needs to be countered. There is, to my opinion, that's clear. But still, the way the European Union deals with association offers, maybe to the southern Mediterranean, to other countries than Russia, to Belarus. I mean, it's not all so clear, I would say. It has been a matter of choice of European governments how to deal with third countries. And I don't think it's adequate always to look at the past as if, you know, we knew in the past what is going to happen now. So the history was more open, I think, 8 years ago than we consider today. Then the second question is about you know, this European dream in economic terms. What I would say here, the EU and the European community at least has been able to correct itself from time to time, let's put it that way. Yeah? For example, agricultural policy in the 60s and 70s was really problematic. You know, there is today talk of racial capitalism. I'm not really sure if one can use this term, and if it describes the reality of European economic management well. Some members of our consortium do think so. I'm not sure. Yeah, But what we can say, I mean, here I'm on that side, that European agricultural policy was exploitation of third countries with much lower levels of welfare. And there the European Union was able to correct itself from time to time. And yeah, and since values are also a thing which are, you know, politically relevant to the members of our consortium, I think this is an ongoing discussion to which extent this European dream of, you know, of building peace within is in collision or on potential collision with the external relations of Europe and the EU.
Mm-hmm. So speaking about Russia and the war in Ukraine, and the values network, can we say that Russia poses more than simply a military threat to the European Union? Because if we have a look, if we pay attention to the rhetoric of Vladimir Putin and the way the Russian foreign policy has been framed since he came back to power in 2012, seems like there's a civilizational dimension which is way more present than it was 20 years ago, and now Russia is kind of presenting itself. I mean, we all know in the Russian collective psyche, the collective psychology, Moscow is considered, they're considering Moscow as the third Rome. So the first two, Rome and Constantinople, they've fallen at the ends of so-called barbarians, and Moscow is the last refuge of genuine Christianity. And in this sense, Russia has some sort of a civilizational goal mission to accomplish, to fight off all these threats to Christian values. And in this perspective, in the rhetoric of Vladimir Putin, he's really pinpointing some values, European values, Western values, that he sees, that he's considering as very problematic in terms of the preservation of what he calls pure Christianity. So would you say that the war in Ukraine is not only a war in itself, a military threat, but it's maybe first and foremost some sort of beginning of a new war of civilization between the Western slash European civilization versus the Russian or Slavophile civilization?
I mean, this would be Huntington's argument, right? I'm not sure. Sometimes I think that this relatively small circle of rulers in Russia around Putin, I'm not sure if they believe what they say. And also, if you look at the history of Russian conservatism, there is an interesting book out by Katharina Blum in German, Russia and the West, Russland and der Westen, which I have just been reading. And there you can see that this discourse of Moscow as the third Rome is by far not the only discourse which is around in Russian conservatism. Her argument is that Russian nationalism has become more and more important, which is not the same as this orthodoxy, because Russia as a multinational state, I think 82%, if I'm not mistaken, are Russian and Orthodox. But what to do with the other 18%? And so the imperial nature of the contemporary Russian state has a lot to deal with keeping these 18% within the country. Think about the Northern Caucasus, for example. And therefore, one could argue that Russian nationalism, rather than orthodoxy, is the direction in which Putin and so on have been arguing in the last 10 years. Well, I have not written this book. I've just read it. I think there is some truth to it. And if we continue with that thought, that it's actually nationalism and not civilizationalism, we have another problem, which is that the cleavage of nationalism vis-a-vis universal values, you know, plays out within the European Union itself. You have a bunch of parties and even governments which think that the nation should come first, that European integration has been going too far, and that nationalism should replace at least parts of what the European Union looks like today. And there you have a link, in fact, not, you have a link of Putin within the European Union, right?
Yes. I mean, some people would say that's actually kind of a fifth column within the European Union, these nationalist, populist parties.
Yeah, I'm trying to evade notions like fifth column, because there is actually a value base. You know, it's a valuation of this process. More neutrally, one could say that it's a big cleavage to in which relation do nation states, national governments, which are usually legitimated, stand to international organizations where rule of law somehow protects the interests of something like a ruling class, which is heavily linked to international capitalism. And this you could certainly say about the EU and the European Commission and the common market. Yeah, you could say this. I'm not saying at the moment that one should, you know, be completely against the setting, but our network is also about acknowledging that these differences in values and valuations exist. And am I completely sure that national democracy is worse than European integration with a lesser component of democracy, of EU democracy? I'm not sure. Yeah, so even there I see an interesting debate. The problem, of course, Putin, you know, should not be mixed with anything close to democracy. Yeah, he's a dictator, and he belongs to the worst dictators Europe has seen in the last 100 years. So here I sometimes miss by less dictatorial nationalists in the European Union steps of denouncing what is happening in Russia and especially in Ukraine. I mean, it's a horror scenario, and it's very important to name those governments and also persons who are responsible for killing 10,000s, 100,000s of people.
So, since we're talking about Ukraine, over the past 2 years, do you think that the European values, irrespective of how we are precisely defining them, but would you say that they have somehow managed to keep the European Union united in its support behind Ukraine? Because I mean, 2 years ago, at the beginning of the war, the support was very, very massive. I don't know how it is right now after 2 years of war. Maybe there's people are tired. Maybe they're starting to feel the economic consequences of this conflict. But maybe were you surprised 2 years ago how the European values were actually a very powerful pool of war that really managed to create a very strong unity in the support of the European Union for Ukraine?
Well, one problem with values is they are linked to emotions, and it's hard for persons playing out these values and emotions to look beyond their own circle of interest. Yeah, it makes it for me difficult to answer, because Viadrina has been one of the German universities which have strongly pledged for solidarity with Ukraine. We have many students from Ukraine. We have hosted and are still hosting scholars from Ukraine. We are building up a center, two centers, I mean, a center and a project for Ukrainian studies. And therefore, I can sometimes not understand really when people say, also some of my colleagues say, there is so few support for Ukraine. Yeah, because simply I see it every day, and I get a lot of emails and so on and so on. So I'm not, it's hard for me to estimate this. Of course, I see that there is certain voices who demand more understanding for Russian positions and so on. To me, it still seems that they're minor positions. Yeah, it would be different if the leader, if the government of a big EU country, I mean, one with military potential, turns into a government which is more or less pro-Putin. Yeah, if Gerhard Schröder, the former German chancellor, would still be chancellor today, the EU might run into trouble. I mean, Putin and Schröder broke both Russian and German laws when Putin allowed Schröder to adopt a child of Russian descent. Yeah, that was, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe. So there is some kind of brotherhood here, which makes it difficult for Schröder to distance himself from Putin. If he still was chancellor, we might run into problems. At the moment, it's, you know, war is about governments, less about movements or populations, like that or not. But as long as the government situation is as it is at the moment, we can see that Italy and France and Germany and Poland, you know, just to name a few of the more decisive countries in that arena, because they have the military resources to help out. Yeah.
Yeah, but their leaders have also, I think, used the European values as a rhetorical tool to maybe silence the opposition, more conservative opposition that are maybe more ideologically closer to the Russian rhetoric. And I think it has played a powerful role 2 years ago in creating this social national unity, maybe more especially in France, maybe more connected with French media, French news than any other country in Europe.
Which is true, but a scholarly network dealing with values starts with the assumption that you have to distrust politicians who come up with values. Yeah, it's not that you distrust in the sense, take a second look. You know, not a distrust in the sense that they're all lying all the time, but I mean, expressing values and working out, acting out these values are different things. I mean, this is the starting point of our network in a way. And what we're trying to do is to apply this to the European level, because a lot of measures and elements of the European Union, like the ones of European bodies, are justified with values. Yeah, and we're exactly saying this deserves a second look. Yeah, you're not a politician beyond control. You're not a civil servant beyond control just because you work in the arena of European values and, you know, express all the time that you're following these values. It's simply, you know, in no democracy this should be assumed, and even less it should be assumed in bureaucratic institutions like the European Union, which have some elements of democracy but which are not complete democracies. It's a multi-layered governance system, a multi-layered democracy. Yeah, so it is very important that networks, including students, including scholars, are aware of the fact that power comes from, you know, from governments, including the European Union and its institutions.
Mm-hmm. How would you say that some of the European values are being if we are to talk about the contestation of European values? What would you say are the values that are the most, that are being challenged the most, and by whom, and maybe for what reason, what purpose?
Well, all values that link democracy to the rule of law are challenged by some political party families, including those in government, for example, in Hungary, or more recently in some time ago in Poland, but there are other West European governments from time to time which have done that as well. So that's one arena. That's a challenge from within. A challenge from without is values regarded to human rights, in the large arena of migration and asylum policy. I think it's empirically an open end, an open question where this will end. But as long as the European Union and its member states have signed, for example, the European Convention on Human Rights, it's, in a democracy, more or less, their duty to follow the values which are connected to that. So there is a big gap, and the European Union gets a lot of criticism from within, but also from without, how it's dealing with its external borders. So these two are important ones. There could be more, but maybe these are the most important ones. I don't know.
So with this example, can we say that maybe it sounds paradoxical, because you can say that some right-wing parties in Europe are challenging human rights and the treatment of immigrants in Europe, maybe for the sake of preserving another so-called European value? Because if you hear the rhetoric of politicians, just Eric Zemmour, for instance, in France, this is basically how he's criticizing immigration. It's not because of, well, according to him, it's not because of racism. It's simply for the sake of preserving the filet social, the social policies of France. And he's basically saying, if we have this nonstop immigration that we cannot regulate, we're going to have to give up some of these fundamental policies that are fundamental to our national identities. So there's something very paradoxical. This is challenging one European value for the sake of saving another one.
Well, I know that positions on this are very diverse within the network. Yeah, very diverse within the network. So to say, on the guilt of politicians or European institutions who might be violating these values. Yeah, so there is a broad variety, which also has to do with the fact if a university is located within the EU or without, or within or outside of the European Union. Well, I touched on this before. National democracy is a value. Yeah. So whatever is felt by communities within these nation states should be considered by politicians. Right. I mean, if you formulate in this way, it's probably not wrong. Yeah. On the other hand, there is human rights which are global. And migration is usually not a phenomenon which is centered on the free will of individuals. People have reasons to migrate, and mostly it's reasons which are unpleasant reasons. Yeah, so there is my position, which is probably challenged within the consortium, is that both values play a role. They need to be leveled out. They need to be leveled out. They cannot and should not, put not played out in a 100% way. But as I said, there is different opinions to this. We probably do not have in the consortium members who on their individual value basis would argue for a return to the nation state as it's demanded by political forces in France, Italy, Denmark, or Hungary. But we have a strong pillar focusing on these challenges from within. And again, my position, which I voice here, is going to be challenged by some members within the consortium. I would think it to be interesting to look at the current Italian government, or also at the way the Rassemblement National in France challenges current AfD positions, which is the German right-wing radical party. So there seem to be nuances. There seem to be nuances, and I see it as my task as a political scientist more to be interested in these nuances than to denounce political forces from the very beginning. And if consequences are bad, they should be further denounced and one should warn against them. I'm not always sure about these populist, so to say, populist sentiments in countries, if they should be denounced from the very beginning. I mean, there is social inequalities in Europe. There is regional imbalances in Europe. There is policies which are of no good for people within or outside of Europe. And I mean, this, you know, these issues should be addressed. And the fact that some political forces exploit them is not a reason enough for me to stay away from them.
Mm-hmm. All right. So before we end this discussion, maybe could you tell us what are the upcoming events that the consortium will be organizing, maybe just for member of academia, individual members of the, of the consortium, but maybe also what the consortium will be doing for the broader public. So there's this podcast series, but is there any other outlets, outputs that the consortium will use to diffuse?
I mean, we have not talked about the website yet. It's the podcast, this is the first podcast, and plans are, as far as I'm informed, to get it out once the webpage is fully equipped. So there you can get most information, in particular on lectures. There's a lecture series which is going to be broadcast always. So it's in presence, and then later on there will be YouTube videos. And they will be announced on a month-to-month basis, let's put it that way. There's a newsletter. And on the homepage, you can push a button to get the newsletter on a regular basis. We have a workshop in Paris in June, in which we will discuss. This is an internal, more or less internal workshop. We will also discuss how to get along with these very complex topics and issues around values. And then there is going to be a conference in Astana, and maybe you are the person to tell even more than me about this. It's going to take place in September. It's going to be the full assembly. And from there, I think this is something also like the general starting point of our network. Everybody will assemble, and all these things like a journal, like journal articles, like maybe books will be discussed there. And afterwards, this part of the project will be flying, I hope.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll be organizing the first annual conference mid-September in Astana. So the topic of the conference will be the contestations of the European values from a non-European context. So I'm still gathering the abstract and the panel proposals. So we're going to make our decisions in about 10 days, 2 weeks from now. Then really looking forward to start building the schedule and start thinking about inviting some pretty impressive and interesting guests as a keynote speakers. So I'm pretty optimistic it's going to be a nice conference and a very good experience for people to visit Kazakhstan as well.
Yeah, and I think it's also symbolic value to open these most important events of the consortium in a non-European country, because a perspective on the EU from outside is very important to us. I mean, the majority of persons and institutions is from within the EU or dealing with EU studies in the sense that it's, you know, not completely off. Alien, but it is always important to consider external perspectives, and it's also enriching.
Yeah, well, and the thing also, Kazakhstan calls itself the art of Eurasia, meaning we are at the intersection of two civilizations, so Europe and Asia, and it's quite astonishing when you're gonna visit the city, just in terms of the architecture. A big part of the architecture is very Asian, but you also have a strong Western tradition. So you can really see, just when you're actually landing, like 5 minutes before landing in Astana, you can see the city from the sky, and you actually see this cohabitation of these two civilizations. So it's not, and it's not just in the architecture, it's also in people's mind. You can really see that people are really westernized in their behavior, but they also have as well their other half, their significant other, which remains also very, very Asian. So symbolically, I think it was a good choice to have this first conference here in Kazakhstan.
Yeah, great. So thank you, Jean-François, for the questions.
Thank you for
this series with me,
for accepting the invitation of being the first guest on the podcast. So the podcast will go online as soon as the website will be online as well. And we hope that we're going to be able to have at least one podcast every 6 weeks. This is the objective. So at the end of the grant in 3 years from now, we'll have at least three dozens of podcasts with various guests from all the partner universities. So
yeah, great.
Thank you for starting the whole thing. And
thank you.
Looking forward to meet you in June in Paris, and then in Astana in September.
And what time is it in Kazakhstan at the moment?
So it's 3:15. So I think with
3:15,
okay. We have just 3 hours time difference.
Yeah. Only 3 hours. That's not only even so much. I thought it was more.
With people in Pittsburgh, however, it's 9 hours. So yeah, it's a bit more tricky to find a proper time to organize our discussions. But we'll do our best. All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.